to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, this is Justin Brierley bringing you another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. Hope you're doing well and that you enjoy today's show, where I was joined by Greg Kokel, who's of course been a long-standing host of the apologetics radio show Stand to Reason, equipping believers with good reasons for their faith and to answer the objections of skeptics. Well, on this show from the archive, Greg talked to three atheists. Stuart questioned whether Christian doctrines of sin and atonement make sense. Bill asked whether the argument from morality makes sense, and Derek pointed out that Christians seem to hear contradictory things from God. Let's get into today's classic replay with Greg Kokel, first broadcast in 2013. Pretty much since I started this programme, he has been a name that's come up time and time again. Listeners from abroad saying, you should get this guy on, Greg Kokel. He's great. He's phenomenal. And here he is, finally in my studio. Greg, thank you for joining
me. Don't build me up too much here, Justin, but it is a pleasure. It is such a pleasure to be back in your country again. This is our third time, and we love it every single time. And it's great to be on your show. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, you are, of course, well-versed in radio yourself. You run a weekly apologetics radio show and podcast, Stand to Reason,
right,
which has been a ministry now for some 20 years.
Yeah, we had a 20-year anniversary. I was doing radio before that, so I'm in my 24th year of call-in radio, live call-in radio, and 20 years with Stand to Reason. Right.
There you go. Fantastic stuff. I mean, you've got, I think, four speakers on team, including
That's
yourself
right.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of training events,
yes.
Loads of resources on the website.
Right. We have over 1,000 pages of just written commentary on the website for covering all kinds of topics, and, of course, the blogs and the video blogs and all of the stuff there. And the radio show is available for podcasts, no cost. And we figure 3 hours a week is easy because most Angelenos, Los Angeles is where I come from, spend at least 3 hours a day on the freeway.
Well, if you want to check it out, and, of course, the links to the podcast and so on, str.org is the website of Greg, Stand to Reason, all aimed at helping Christians to defend the faith. So tell me how you got into it in the first place. Was this because you were being asked hard questions,
well,
Greg?
I became a follower of Christ in 1973 when I was a student at UCLA. So I was an adult. And when I became a Christian, I, of course, during that time was pummeled by many questions just like people are now. And I was interested in having answers to the questions myself as well as helping others to understand. And so I just kind of gravitated towards this. I was in a pre-law program before I got into a psychology program at UCLA. So maybe my mind is just kind of bent that way, whatever. But and as time went on, as I learned more about Christianity and the Bible and the things that other thoughtful Christians had to say in defense of their own convictions, I not only absorbed it, but I began to pass that on to other followers of Christ and to other skeptics who were challenging. And I just got great satisfaction out of that, and I saw the impact on other people's lives. So
you found your calling
after a fashion. That's right. Yeah.
And it includes a book that came out not so long ago, Tactics.
That's right. This is my fourth or fifth book. I don't know. I lose count. Mm. This particular one is called Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. And in the field of apologetics, there's lots of information, Justin, you know, that you can get into your head. But there's a missing bridge, I think, between the content and the conversation, between the scholarship and the relationship. And so this book is meant to provide that bridge. I call it a game plan. And it really focuses on using particular tools, maneuvers, and conversations that will help you kind of stay in the driver's seat so you can have genuine, gracious interactions with people that are not pressured, that are not nasty, but are also productive. Yeah. And so that's the goal of the Tactics book.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard Michael Ward, another apologist, talk about the danger of apologetics become about moving intellectual counters in a game of chess.
Yes, uh-huh.
But with no real sort of impact on any individual.
Yeah, there is a place for that, or that is one element, because we are talking about specific ideas and whether our ideas or other ideas in the marketplace of ideas really hold water, if they're defensible, if they're reasonable, if we ought to believe them or not. And so there are these moves that have to be made, because that's the way thoughtful discussion is had. But whether or not they persuade people is another issue. issue. Mm. And we find if there's a lot of grace involved in the conversation, it's more persuasive. But people ultimately are going to have to make up their own mind on these things. And what we try to show is that Christianity is worth thinking about.
I mean, I just want to talk to you really just before we come to one of our first callers. And I should say actually at the outset that what we're going to be doing with Greg today is taking a few skeptical callers to air, a number of different issues that are going to be coming up, because I see you as a sort of an all-rounder, to use a cricketing term.
Generalist, yes, that's right.
You know, over the 20 years you've been doing it, I'm sure you must have just kind of investigated all kinds of different areas, and so you see yourself as having quite
master at none, but you know.
Jack of all, master of none.
Right.
Well, we're going to be hearing on the show today from Stuart, who's going to be asking whether Christianity, even if one accepts the stories in the Bible, whether the doctrine itself is incoherent. He wants to ask about sin and atonement today on the show. We're going to be hearing from Bill as well, I think coming from the States, Bill. He keeps hearing Christians talk about objective morality. Well, does that prove God exists? He begs to differ. And finally, Derek is another listener of the show who's going to be asking whether God is a poor communicator later on in the program. So those are some of the topics that you can expect on today's show. But when it comes to doing your radio show, Greg, here on Unbelievable, we've kind of tried to have this model of non-Christian-Christian interaction.
Right.
How does it work on yours? Because you've often got a Christian guest joining you, but you're also taking calls, aren't you?
Yes.
On a variety of subjects.
Yeah, well, think of the mission of our organization. The mission statement starts with these words, we train Christians. So we are not principally an evangelistic organization. Mm. We are principally a training organization. And so what I try to do on the radio is be available to help answer challenges that Christians experience or may even have themselves. And these might be challenges from the outside, as it were, outside of Christianity, or within, theologically within. Stuart's going to raise some concerns about the internal coherence of the notion of atonement. And so these are all the legitimate kind of issues to talk about. And so I my goal is to try to help followers of Christ to make sense of this. But, of course, we get a lot of non-Christians that call in, skeptics, atheists, the like, and something like 10 or 15% of our callers are of that stripe. And I'm glad to have them on board. And in part because I've spoken in more than 65 universities around the country and in the States and in other places. And so there are lots of non-believers in the audiences.
Yeah.
If I'm talking about the ideas that we have that are substantial and defensible and also a tactic on how to interact with people, I've got to be able to do that myself to be able to model it to others. So both of those things, Justin, are going on the show.
Are there any memorable calls that stick in your memory from all those years of taking them?
They're 24. Yeah, 24 years, there are a few that stick. I use them for illustrations to make other points, and this is why they stick. But I have to say, and I don't know how you have fewer people through your lines, as it were, when I have a dozen callers maybe on a show. My listeners remember my callers better than I do. You know, it's a crazy thing. And they'll tell me, remember this guy or that guy, somebody I'll meet at an event. Or this fellow, he keeps calling. And I think, I'm just taking it one at a time, you know. And so, and also I just turned 63, so I think that means things flow in one ear and out the other more easily there, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's get straight into talking to our first caller on today's show. It is what sometimes I call the Grill a Christian show. So Greg Kokel gets grilled today is the idea, with a variety of topics. And I'm very happy to say that a few people who listen to the show on a regular or semi-regular basis have volunteered to come on and put a few of their skeptical questions to Greg. So our first caller is Stuart. Stuart, you'll have to help me with your surname because I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it. Could you pronounce it for me?
Yeah, sure. It's Ingruil.
Ingruil. Okay. Yeah. Sounds semi-French or something.
Yes,
I'm not sure.
It is.
Okay.
There's a lot of French ties to where I live.
Can I just call you Stuart instead of Mr. a name I can't pronounce?
That's fair enough.
I've had a bit of trouble with the languages over here, and I'm still trying to find someone here in the UK that speaks proper English.
Well, look, Stuart, thanks for coming on the show today. We haven't got a lot of time, so obviously we need to get to your point quickly. But you've actually sort of had a little self-published book that you've written called Unbelievable, funnily enough, Christianity as a House of Cards. And the idea, I think, is that your claim is that even if you could show, even if you could accept the stories in the Bible, that wouldn't make the Christian doctrine coherent. So we can't obviously tackle everything there. But particularly, we're going to talk today about sin and atonement, Jesus dying for our sins. What's your question on that front?
It's not so much a question as I've got a series of objections to the entire concept of a blood sacrifice. Mm. And I've never really understood why someone needs to die, or in other words, how does death pay for sin? What is it about bloodshed that gives it an atoning quality? What kind of mechanism is at work?
Mm-hmm.
But the other objection that I have is, perhaps we should deal with that one first.
Well, yeah. Let's see how we go on with that. Okay.
In the States, when we want to refer to the government administration acting in a certain way, we simply say the White House says, and you probably have the same thing for Downing Street or something like that, where the PM will make a statement. Is that kind of a familiar type figure of speech to you, Stuart?
Yes, sure. Yeah.
So sometimes one word that is a word that captures a small thing or a limited thing is really meant to stand in for a much larger thing. And I think there's actually a technical word for this, and I don't know in English, but I don't know what it is for this type of figure. But this is what happens when the scripture talks about the blood of Christ and the death of Christ. It is using a specific word to really refer to a whole range of things that are going on, to the whole nature of Jesus giving himself for others, on behalf of others. Now, I read in your book interesting illustrations that you give there, Stuart, about someone having a fine before the government and having that fine paid. And you can understand the intelligibility of one person paying a fine for somebody else. So in the paying of the fine, the first person who was the guilty one, who owed the fine but didn't pay, is still, in a sense, let off the hook. That crime is resolved as far as the government is concerned. So it seems to me your own metaphor captures the sense of substitution there. Am I on the right track here? Is your understanding of the metaphor, at least?
Yeah. What I would say to that, though, is that the fine's paid, but the person is still guilty.
Oh, well, that's absolutely right. You mentioned in the book that the person who is forgiven by God for a murder gets away with murder. And that is true with every single act of forgiveness, human or divine. Every single time someone does something wrong and the wrongdoing is forgiven, the notion of forgiveness is to release the debt. It is to release that which is owed. Stuart, if you owed me a million pounds, and that's a whole lot more than a million in America right now, unfortunately, because I'm spending my American at a reduced rate here in London, but if you owed me a million, and let's just say that the million-pound debt was a bona fide debt, a genuine debt, and you came to me and you said, I can't repay that. And I said, all right, Stuart, I forgive your debt. Don't you, in fact, get away with $1 million? A million six.
More than $1 million.
Yeah, $1,600,000. Don't you get away with £1 million that you didn't earn and you didn't deserve, that was owed someone else? When I forgive you, didn't you get away with that?
Yeah.
But that's the point of forgiveness. That's exactly the point. And when all of us have so many crimes against God that we owe, he gives us an opportunity, a rescue plan out of this unbelievable debt that we have, so that, and you put it rightly, so that they can get away with murder.
So what's the I sense then there must be a follow-up question here from you, Stuart.
Well, there was, but just to stick with this, That's just like taking away your responsibility for something. It's throwing your responsibility for your actions onto somebody else.
Well,
and blood is the payment. That seems awfully macabre. I can't imagine any court demanding blood.
Right. We'll get to the blood in just a moment. My summary response, though, to this first issue is what you've described is true, and it's true about any act of forgiveness in any circumstance. There is a getting away with. That's absolutely right. Now, oftentimes when someone is relieved of a debt, it creates a tremendous sense of gratitude and a change in life, and this is part of the whole package here, but that's another issue. So it isn't just like people can do whatever they want and then they get off and then they could do it again. That's not the way the system works, but insofar as you've identified that forgiveness means that you get away with it, I have to cop to that. That is a fair way of putting it, and that actually is the virtue in my view, not the vice. If it were a vice, then all forgiveness is a vice. But it seems to most people like forgiveness is a virtue. Now, the issue of the blood, though, this is another thing where you have a word standing in for a whole thing. God isn't up there kind of measuring how many drops of blood came out of Jesus' body. This is a picture. This is a picture that is meant to represent a larger thing, and that is the suffering. The blood is to represent the suffering that was experienced by Jesus in payment so that forgiveness could be given. So it is not just blood dripping or Jesus ceasing to breathe, like dying, and then raising again the next day so that, in your book, as you put it, Jesus' life was only on loan. He didn't give his life. It was loan because he died, but he got it back again 3 days later. So what kind of punishment is that? The punishment was, and you're familiar enough with the Gospels, Stuart, to remember that Jesus hung on the cross for 3 hours, and there was darkness over that cross on 3 hours. And what was going on during that time was that God the Father was pouring out a vicious, unconscionable, unbelievable punishment upon Jesus that was adequate to pay for the crimes of every man that was ever committed. That is the punishment. It isn't the blood that he's... I mean, I bleed. You bleed. You and I are both going to die. And so even if we died for someone, like you or I threw ourselves on a grenade or something to save somebody else's life, that still wouldn't accomplish the kind of thing, though that would be considered a great merit if we'd done that. That doesn't accomplish the thing that Jesus did, because what he did was suffer a punishment directly from the Father, which is why he cried out as he did on the cross. That's the issue, the suffering.
Yeah, when you talk about his punishment on the cross, I say in my book, I stack that up against what can be expected for the unbeliever after they die. Hell.
Right.
Eternity in hell. I can't quite square the two things. If Jesus had died on the cross and then was sent to hell permanently and was suffering for all eternity, then I could say, well, perhaps, yeah, he's taken on our punishment.
Can I just ask at this point, Stuart, when you say Jesus was sent to hell, are you kind of reading into the passage where it talks about Jesus descended into Hades as the idea that Jesus went to hell?
Oh, no, I'm aware of that passage, and I think there's something to that effect in the Apostles' Creed.
In later versions.
I'm not...
I think your sense is that he suffered what we would suffer in hell. That's the point you're making.
Yeah, right. Okay. In order for it to be fair, in inverted commas, if he really was taking on our burden, our punishment, he would be, and bear in mind this is for everyone, not just for one person.
Right.
I would have thought that the punishment would be rather more strict.
Yes,
as it is, he's up and around after 3 days.
Right, it is a absolutely sensational question, and it's one I raised for a church about 3 months ago when I spoke, because if Jesus was merely a man, how can a mere man suffer a temporal amount of time, not only to pay for the eternal punishment of one individual, as you've pointed out, but also, as you've added, for everyone? And this would be essentially an impossibility if Jesus were a mere man. this is why the fact that God became a man was absolutely essential. If it's the God-man, there is a qualitative element that's involved in the work of the cross that could not be accomplished by any mere man. And actually, there was a book that was written 1,000 years ago by a guy named Anselm that is called Why the God-Man, because he's explaining why God had to become a man and this to save mankind. And it is this very problem that you're pointing to that is solved. Wouldn't be solved by a mere man, but it is solved by the God-man suffering in a temporal amount of time, an adequate punishment to secure eternal salvation for anyone who trusts in him.
I guess I just say that if you're looking to people like Anselm writing 1,000 years ago, that's an example of someone who's noticed a potential problem with their doctrine and has come up with a potential answer to it.
Absolutely. Well, that's exactly the point.
You're not going to find that in the Bible, though, are you? You're not going to find an explanation like
no,
that.
No, well, you don't find the statements of Anselm in the Bible. What you do find is the rationale in the Bible as you study through it. Why is it necessary that God became a man to do something that no man can do? That you find in the Bible. Referring to Anselm 1,000 years ago, I don't know why the time has anything to do with. I raised the point. That doesn't disqualify his point. My point is that this question that you've raised is a legitimate question. It's one that's been around for a long time, and it's one that was answered in a coherent way a long time ago.
I mean, this is overall the issue that you raise across the whole of this book you've written, isn't it, Stuart? The question of the coherence of Christian doctrine, even if you accepted the history of Christianity, would the doctrines themselves make sense? And you believe that you're pointing out various flaws. Now, obviously, theologians have wrestled with some of the questions mm-hmm. you've brought up time and again down the years. Is there a kind of another point here that you're making, though, that somehow these doctrines should be manifestly obvious just from an initial reading of Scripture, and you shouldn't have to do this kind of thinking through these things in kind of a afterwards type of way?
Yeah, exactly that. I say in my book that given that what Christians claim is that so much is at stake, I would have thought it should be painfully obvious to even the most obtuse person.
Well, all you're saying, Stuart, is that you would have done it differently. You haven't demonstrated an incoherence in the doctrine, that that there's some kind of contradiction. A contradiction is a very particular kind of thing, either A or non-A. And if you say A and non-A, then you have two statements that are inconsistent with each other logically. But nothing like that has been put forward. What has been put forward is kind of a scratching of the head. This doesn't make sense to me, which I understand that. But what I've tried to offer is plausible answers to what you've stated. It's entirely plausible that the problem that you stated about how a man can pay for all men in a finite period of time could be rectified by the fact that he's not just a man, that on Christian doctrine he is God incarnate. And insofar as the challenge is of the Christian account, then we are within our rights then to resolve it within the Christian account to show that there's no incoherency. Is it amazing? Absolutely. Is it imponderable in many ways? Absolutely. But that's very different from being incoherent.
I wasn't trying to postulate a formal logical fallacy or anything of that kind. I'm more talking about common sense, and I would have thought that if words like fairness and even-handedness are going to mean anything, then the average person should be able to apply their common sense to these things.
Well, I'm not sure how fairness and even-handedness enter into this particular issue.
If it isn't obvious, given that so much at stake, if it isn't painfully obvious, so that if you were going to deny the existence of God, deny Jesus as your Savior, you would have to do it knowingly, willingly.
Well, yes.
You'd have to be able to do it knowing that what was at stake, sure. knowing that you would
well, go that to hell quite and not care. That is quite simple. Knowing what it is at stake is quite simple. Crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's of theology and how all of this works: substitutionary atonement, propitiation, spiritual death, spiritual new life. All of these things are things that come later and are not necessary to resolve the issue you're pointing to, which is salvation. If salvation required all of this heavy theology, then all of this heavy theology should be clear to the rank and file. All salvation requires here, though, is an acknowledgement of one's guilt and an acknowledgement that there is a provision for that guilt and a trusting in it. That's it. Not high theology. A child, my little girl was 6 years old when she was baptized, and she didn't understand all the stuff about the ins and out of the why the God-man and substitutionary atonement and propitiation, etc. But she did know that Jesus died in her place, and if she trusts him, God will forgive her for her sins. That's okay, simple, and that's the foundation.
We are going to have to move on, I'm afraid, Stuart. So if you want to just, I think we are going to have to actually, time is against us, so we're going to have to say goodbye. But Stuart, really good of you to come on and have this interaction.
Thank you so much, Stuart.
And I'll try and link somehow to where people can find out a bit more about your book as well from the podcast.
Okay.
All the very best. Thank you for being with us on the show today.
No problem.
That was Stuart, and kicking things off as our first caller with my special guest today, Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. If you want to find out more about Greg and his ministry and the podcast and radio show he runs, because there are other good apologetics radio shows out there, believe it or not, str.org is the place to go. Thank you very much, Stuart, and we're going to be hearing in the next section of today's show from Bill and Derek, so stay tuned. We're going to be back with more questions for Greg Kokel here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio. Every Saturday afternoon, I try to bring you something interesting, either between two Christians who are discussing an issue, or very often Christians and non-Christians who are debating some issue of faith and belief. And it's my great pleasure to be joined on the show today by Greg Kokel. He's getting grilled. Greg is the host himself of a weekly apologetics radio show and podcast, Stand to Reason. If you haven't heard of it, and you'd like to check it out, I do encourage you to go over to the website there, str.org, because there's just a huge number of articles. I've often found it really helpful myself, actually, when engaging with some issue. I thought, I'm sure STR will have something to say about that, and it's all laid out there. In fact, you just relaunched the website recently.
We did, about 6 weeks ago, fresh and brand spanking new. So yeah. It's really nice to look at after the old style and much more easy to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely. So do check it out, str.org. Lots of resources there. We're going to be going to Bill in just a moment's time, Greg. What I haven't asked you at the outset, though, is what you're actually doing here in the UK. You've been doing some teaching, some talks, and that kind of thing.
Right. We were with in Cambridge for the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And
with Christian Heritage?
Christian Heritage. They put on a Cambridge Summer School of Apologetics. They put on a Cambridge Summer School of Theology and a Summer School of Counseling as well. And the wonderful folks at Christian Heritage, and they asked me to come out for 5 days, and we did lectures in the afternoon and the morning, sometimes the evening. We had dinner together. We interacted together. We saw Cambridge together. It was a fabulous 5 days of learning. And my legs were tired from standing so much and my jaw a bit sore, but I met some fabulous people, and that's what has me.
Well, I really appreciate you making the time to come over and join me on the show today. As I say, I've had so many people over the years say you should get Greg Kokel on, and I'm sure there's lots of people who are going to be tuning in today for that very reason. Now, on the show today, we're taking a few different callers, slightly different format to usual, what I sometimes call our Grill a Christian format. Mm-hmm. And Greg is the Christian being grilled today. We've already heard from Stuart with his questions about the coherency of Christian doctrine. Well, now we're going to hear from Bill, who is a caller from the States. We have a lot of listeners to the podcast out in the States. Bill is one of them. And Bill, I understand you've got a question about objective morality. So welcome to the show. And do you want to let us know what your question is?
Sure. Well, we're all familiar with the so-called argument for morality, but I don't really want to debate that as a test of whether God exists or not.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather explore it a little bit and try to understand better how Christians think about it. So for the time being, let's just suppose that these objective morality does exist.
Mm-hmm.
My question then is really, okay, if the objective morality exists, where do I find essentially the list of rules of behavior that derive from that objective
mm-hmm.
morality?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I find out what behavior is morally correct in a new situation?
Okay, yeah, good question, Bill. Let me put it this way. When we are considering morality, there are a couple of different things that are in play in the process of considering the morals in question. And one of them is, I mean, think of it this way. We have a capacity to think in moral categories, all right? And we also have content to those moral categories. I know your question is about the content, but I'm just building a kind of a picture here for people to understand how this works. By parallel, for example, we have eyes that have a capacity for seeing. Now, if our eyes are closed, we're not going to see anything, okay? But if our eyes are open, it is the eyes that have the capacity to see that gaze around on the landscape and look at things. Now, it often is the case that people see things differently. And if I see something I think is blue and you think it's red, then maybe we'll have a conversation about what color it actually is. But because there is some discussion about the nature of the color between us, doesn't mean that the thing we're looking at is not colored. And so when it comes to morality, we have a capacity to think in terms of right and wrong. And I'm just going to observe this capacity in everybody. And I suspect if I talked with you very long, Bill, I'd see comments that you made that were reflected that you are thinking in terms of right or wrong. Now, you apparently reject objective morality. Okay, that's fine. But you have this capacity. So I'm going to say, since everybody has this capacity, except for somebody who's not properly equipped and a person who does not have any convictions about right or wrong at all is usually referred to as a sociopath. I don't mean a philosophic person, but a person who genuinely has no conscience and right and wrong mean nothing to that person, just utter self-interest. So most people are asking themselves the question, what is the right thing to do? And the way we go about finding this out, at least the most primitive or basic way, is just use the sense that we have, just like our eyes, to look around. And we pay attention to things, and there's a certain seemingness about it, just like things seem to our eyes. We look around and we see some kind of brutal behavior, and we say, you know what, that's not right. And we see other kinds of behavior that may be similar to that, and we see that's not right. I don't think that a person has to believe in writers in order to read. We of course, there's got to be writers in order to be able to have anything to read, but that's a separate question. What we're talking about is the ability to read. Let's leave writers out. And in this case, the writer is God writing morality. Let's just leave God out for a minute. I think every human being has the capability, this seeing capacity, to be able to look around his world and try to figure out what are the correct things to do that correspond with his natural inclination to see certain types of behaviors as right or wrong. This is what political debate is all about. The irony here is, though, turns out we agree on a whole bunch of things without having anyone tell us. And this becomes our common moral shared sensibilities. I think the reason that we agree on the foundational things so much is because we're actually all seeing the same thing, but we're seeing with the faculty of our moral reasoning or our moral intuition and not with our and not with eyes. But and so to answer your question, the way one goes about this, regardless of what they happen to believe in God, the way one goes about this is uses that capacity we all have, that faculty, and begins to examine the world and ask what seems right and is involved in discussions with other people. And it's not a coin flip. It's not like anything goes and whoever says whatever they want, that's fine for them. We're able to see things largely the same. New situations, we adapt from old situations. That is, if we see some say that abusing a human being is wrong in some sense, then we see that rape is a kind of abuse like that, mm-hmm. and so rape would be wrong in the same way. So there's a very, okay. very quick and simple.
Yeah. So where's this leading, I suppose, is my next question to you, Bill. What is that a satisfactory explanation for you of the way we might perceive morality as being objective?
It's satisfactory to me because I agree with it, but I don't see how it's distinguished, how what Craig said is any different from what any non-believer could say.
Yeah, it isn't. That's part of my point at this part. We're not talking in terms of grounding morality, and I feel safe given the explanation that I gave because this is the kind of thing every single one of us does unconsciously or implicitly.
The image you used there of two people may disagree on the color of an object, but mm-hmm. the object still has a specific color.
Right.
One, it's either blue or red right. or whatever. Now, if you apply that to morality, you and Bill might disagree on the morality of a particular issue mm-hmm. or action, but the fact is, it is either right or wrong. Mm-hmm. That's kind
right.
of what you're saying right now. Bill, is your problem that you don't think there is actually an actual color in the sense of morality, that there is no actual moral value that can be assigned to particular things because it's all, in the end, personal opinion rather than an objective morality that's out there?
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly that way. The idea that there is a right or wrong, I think we're agreed on that. I think where we would probably disagree is what the source of that.
So I can be clear here, are you saying you do then actually believe there is an objective moral facts of the matter?
No, I'm saying that there can be right or wrong without it being objective and absolute.
Well, I agree. There can be right or wrong. That is, we can use those words to describe our behavior, but we are talking about something very, very different when we talk about a subjective right or wrong, which is what you just described, and an objective right or wrong. See, for you, I imagine that harming children for the pleasure it brought you would be terribly wrong. It would be for me, too. But if we were in a relativistic world, Justin might enjoy it immensely, and we would have no claim against him if morals were just up to the individual. That's relativism. If it was right for Justin, then the word right would apply to the behavior of harming children for the pleasure it brought him. That would be right for him, and it would be wrong for him not to do it. On the relativistic system, those are the way the rules work. Now, if that offends somebody deeply, and I don't mean like they're emotionally bothered, but that just seems to be wrong. That's a inaccurate way of looking at it. It's probably because they're aware that this kind of harming of children is not just a subjective wrong, like that's what we happen to believe, but regardless of who believes otherwise, it's wrong for everybody. That would make it an objective wrong.
Okay. Yeah. Your response to that, Bill?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what Greg said there.
Well, I guess he's just pointing out that if you believe right and wrong are subjective in the sense that, well, I believe it, but someone else might, in another culture or time, might believe that what I think is right is actually wrong or vice versa. That's
Which
hard
they
to
certainly do.
That's yeah, absolutely. But it's hard to reconcile with the fact that for certain actions, like harming small children for fun, that just doesn't seem. You know, I can't believe that that's actually. There is a situation where for somebody else that can be the right thing to do. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I do. And the trouble is every time this question is asked, and the original question I asked was, what is this list of objective moral truths?
So is your question then?
And everybody always answers it by saying, well, don't harm children.
Is that on the list? Yeah, that would be
there must
list.
Be a more extensive list than that.
Well, that's a place to start. We're just talking about one thing right now, Bill, and you want to build a catalog of harms, then you do the work of reflection to determine that. By the way, it's largely been done. Let's just take the Ten Commandments, for example. There's a list that virtually on every single item most people will consider that these things are legitimate moral obligations pertaining to human beings. So, I mean, these lists have been made based on moral reflection, but there's no other way to...
Well, most Christians, anyway.
No, this is true for non-Christians as well. I talk to non-Christians all the time who don't... Who are against capital punishment because it's wrong to kill. They're not religious folk. They also don't think you should steal their money or steal their good name or steal their paper that they wrote for university. I mean, virtually all of these things are things. If I start looking at another man's wife in an inappropriate way, he thinks that's wrong. He could be an atheist and he still thinks that's wrong. These are lying. I mean, these are all things that people characteristically think are morally problematic.
I suppose, just to bring my
perspective... Well, the first part of the Ten Commandments is certainly not...
Well, obviously, the bit about love, honor God, keep the Sabbath holy may not apply
right.
for a lot of atheists. Right. I understand what you're saying there, Bill. But I mean, for me, Bill, the question you seem to be saying is, well, given there's so much grey areas in our morality, how can you talk about this list of objective moral? I suppose I would take it back to, well, even though we disagree on certain issues where it's not entirely obvious, say, the principle underlying it does still come down to an objective moral fact of the matter. So the reason we might be arguing about whether capitalism is right or, socialism is right is because... we both actually believe in fairness of some kind. There's a kind of an underlying principle
right.
of the matter. So whether or not we can say this is the objective moral fact of the matter, we're still kind of agreeing that there is an objective issue at stake. Does that make sense, Bill?
Well, it makes sense. I'm not sure I agree with it.
Well, let me put it quickly this way. Virtually, I suspect you engage in public... political discussion or debate or back and forth with people. All political discussion is moral discussion. That is, it is all discussion about what is the right and proper use of power. So when you have political discussion with your friends, you are doing the very thing that I'm suggesting. You are reflecting on the nature of the circumstances, and you are trying to figure out what the right thing to do is under that unique set of circumstances, and then persuade others of that thing.
Right, but what I'm not doing is trying to ferret out what that right thing to do is from some distant objective set of truth. I'm trying to figure out with my friends or whoever it is that I'm discussing what a good approach would be for human beings.
Yes, but the good approach you're identifying is not a distant thing, and it is objective. You are not saying to your friends, this is my personal opinion, has nothing to do with your behavior, you do whatever your little heart desires. You are trying to argue for the right result here. However it is that you ground that, that's what you're arguing for. Just reflect on it next time you get in a political discussion.
Bill,
I'm trying to argue for is a right result. That is one that we can agree upon among ourselves, not the right result, which somehow exists.
All right. Well, let you have a bit last word
We'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much, Bill. Really appreciate you because you've got up at a really early hour of the morning to talk to us from where you're calling from in the States. But all the very best. Keep looking into that issue. Great to have you with me on the show today. We're taking calls with Greg Kokel today on Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and a really great pleasure to have Greg in the studio with me today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Derek is a regular listener to the show, has emailed in on numerous occasions over the years. So great to have you finally in person, as it were, if only by phone, Derek. But thank you for calling in today. Let's get straight to the issue. What did you want to ask Greg about today?
Hi, Justin. Yeah, it's great to be talking to you. And it's Greg. It seems to me one of the issues that I see with a sort of, I'm coming from an atheist humanist sort of worldview, And so I don't think God exists. And it seems to me that if he did, he's very poor at communicating. And the first example I'd want to bring is the sort of internal debates that always happen in the church. Probably at the moment the biggest one is homosexuality. And if you look a year or two ago, the Anglican Church was in a synod debating this, and you'd have sort of person A speaking sort of in an impassioned way on a liberal view and person B with a conservative view. And you're talking here about two people who are both dedicated their lives to Christianity, and they both pray, read the Bible, you know, and good, honest people. They're looking, they both show they've got a relationship with God. And yet, although it's a straightforward sort of fairly yes-no things, are we going to allow gay bishops or not? God doesn't seem to get together and knock their heads together, you know, like you would see in a big organisation. If one middle manager says one thing, another says another that isn't compatible, you know, the boss would sort them out.
And if God is all-powerful, then surely he should be able to make abundantly clear.
It's not so much the all-powerful, it's the idea that Christians believe they have a relationship with God. They're always praying to God, they talk about having guidance and so on. In practice, it doesn't seem to be happening, certainly in this scenario and many others.
All right. Good to talk to you. Derek, it sounded there at just the end you introduced a new topic. Let me stick with the first one, though, that had to do not so much with the hiddenness of God, but really what might be considered ambiguities in his communication to men, such that you can have good people on two sides of a controversial issue. As you put it, they are dedicated, they pray, they're honest, they have a relationship with God, but they come up on opposite sides of the issue. Let's just switch the circumstances just a little bit. What if I said that I have two friends that are dedicated, honest, genuine, kind, all of these virtues. One of them says 2 + 2 = 4, and the other one says 2 + 2 = 9. Well, in that circumstance, it's clear that the virtues that I just identified have nothing to do with whether or not they can get their sums right. Those virtues are unrelated. All it says is that they're good, they have the best of intentions. That's all it says. And the same thing is true about the debate on homosexuality. These people have the best of intentions. The real question is that they're faced with has to do with something like sums. What does the Bible teach? Now, in this regard, there is very little ambiguity as to what the Bible teaches. In fact, I just taught on this issue the other day, and we don't have to get into a pitched discussion about the biblical case about this, but between the Genesis passage, the Leviticus passage, and the Romans passage, there is a very, very clear statement about homosexuality. Now, a lot of people don't like that, or they don't even want to believe it, and they're welcome not to do so. But the evidence is there to come to a clear conclusion about what the spiritual sums are, so to speak, with regards to homosexuality. That people who are dedicated, who pray, who are honest, and have a relationship with God don't agree on that does not mean the text is unclear. And what one needs to do on those kinds of things is go back to the text. This is not a case where God has been hidden in the information. This is a case where a lot of people have changed their mind under public pressure. Now you've got another factor that's come into play, and I think that explains the differences in the problems more than anything else.
Yeah, it's not quite the question I was asking. I took the homosexuality issue just as an example of debate within church.
Okay.
You know, it could have been, I could have said women bishops. Or
right.
Women leaders.
By the way, Derek, this point was raised, something like this was raised by the American atheist Michael Shermer to me about the differences among Christians. And I mentioned that's a good argument against science, because science is thick with differences of opinion, but we don't question the legitimacy of the enterprise just because people disagree. Good people disagree.
Well, I would dispute that, because you've got a consensus in science and there is, you know, solid bedrock. It's only around the edges. Whereas this thing, for example, the homosexuality issue is liable to split the Anglican Church.
Well,
in,
it may split.
Well.
It still arguably is around the edges in certain kinds of ways. But I was simply making the point that mere dispute about something doesn't disqualify the possibility of proper answers in there. Mere dispute. And there have been huge disputes in science, but nobody writes off science simply because there have been massive disputes.
Is there another issue? There was another kind of example, perhaps, you know, Greg.
Perhaps there are, although I think we can follow this one a little bit further. I mean, instead of the science analogy, if we look at the analogy I was making of people working for the same boss in the same organization,
mm-hmm.
Because I'm not really thinking of people looking at scripture and getting different mm-hmm. answers. I was really talking about the real genuine... People do people have a relationship with God? Does God talk to people? Does he guide them? And if so, you know, can we see that happening?
Yeah.
And why aren't we seeing it happening?
It's that
on
question
the
of
big scale?
If you believe you're in touch with God through Jesus, then how come you're coming up with a different view, different theology to someone over there who's claiming exactly the same thing? And is your conclusion, therefore, Derek, that actually neither of them's actually hearing from God, presumably, as far
well,
as you're concerned.
Obviously, it looks quite clear cut from outside. Both sides are, you know, that nobody's talking to them.
Well,
know?
I don't know.
They're both making it up from the book they happen to have and the views that they've come to mm-hmm. For whatever reason.
Well, Derek, I don't know in this discussion about homosexuality, for example, anybody that's making the claim, I'm hearing from God and this is what God is telling me. I hear arguments of a different sort. Those who are conservatives are arguing from the scripture. And do they have the same boss? I don't know. That's a good question. I've asked myself that same question when I've heard this kind of debate. Are you guys reading from the same book I am if you're following the same God I am? How come that you come up with this point of view that seems contrary to the stated teaching of the scripture? Now, you know, there may be some debate about the details, but it seems to me pretty straightforward in the text. This is why we have a Bible, by the way. This is one of the virtues of having objective criterion instead of just people weighing in with their feelings on it. We have to continue to go back to the thing that is given as the authority for doctrine.
I mean, if I could weigh in here, Derek, could it be suggested that the fact that humans tend to disagree about what God has commanded in Scripture or wherever is because we're human, and that is just the factor that needs to be factored in, that Christians would be the first to say we're fallen, and so it's inevitable that when this stuff gets worked out in our human factor, you know, there will be our fallenness will come in and mm-hmm. will mean that we don't get it right. There will be disagreements and so on.
Yeah, I quite understand. You know, if we're fallen, then we're going to hear imperfectly, and we're going to interpret things imperfectly. But that seems to me, certainly from my own experience, in my Christian days.
You were formerly a Christian, Derek.
Yeah. There was one particular thing, in actual fact, which probably helped in my coming away from the faith, where I really felt sure I was guided. It's my choice of what I wanted to do for a career and for a university course. And you know, I felt this guidance for you know, a long mm-hmm. time, and other people around me sort of didn't, nobody gainsaid it or mm-hmm. what have you. Everyone was very supportive. And it turned out terribly. And I spent 5 years studying something that I mm-hmm. ever hated and have never used, and you know, it's probably stopped me going down avenues that would be much more fruitful for me and things.
Mm-hmm.
And reflecting on that, it made me feel, if I could be so badly wrong about that, you know, I felt like I had a relationship with God. I felt that I was being guided. And if I was so wrong about that, I'm probably wrong about it. It just looked much more sensible to think mm-hmm. I'd actually just been fooling myself.
Well, I have a quick answer for that, Derek. I think the theology that you are following regarding guidance is not biblical theology. And I have to confront this all the time among American Christians who pursue guidance the same way you did and find and run into all kinds of difficulties. And then I have to show them, and it's somewhat a lengthy or more tedious process, but to show them from the scripture that this is not God's way of guiding. No wonder you ran into these problems. You were using a non-biblical means of guidance, and then you got yourself caught in a mess and then ended up blaming God or the Bible. I'm sympathetic to your circumstance, believe me, Derek, but I think the problem here is that not that there was no God, but that the method you were using was not a sound method.
We are running out of time, I'm afraid, Derek, and we've just got some really interesting stuff there in terms of your own personal journey, but maybe it's something we could pick up another time. But Derek, appreciate you calling in today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Derek.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
For being the sounding board today. Derek there, our final caller on the show today. Just out of time in this part of the show, so we're going to finish up our chat with Greg Kokel, my guest on Unbelievable today. I'm Justin Brierley. Join us again in a couple of minutes' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, time to say goodbye to my guest, Greg Kokel, who has been taking calls from a variety of listeners to the show in the last hour or so. We heard from Stuart talking about Christian doctrine, Bill asking about objective morality, and just in the last part there, Derek asking whether God's a poor communicator given that people come up with different ideas. I guess all questions that you've come across a number of times in the course of your career.
Yeah, in one way or another, after 24 years of doing radio and taking callers, they sometimes there are different variations, but it's amazing how often you come back to the morality question. It's huge. The moral argument for the existence of God, I think, is a powerful argument, and I think this is one, and it's very, very difficult for the rank and file to deny objective morality, at least implicitly. You know, they say, well, there's no objective morality, but then they talk like there is. And so now they want to hold on to morality in some sense, but they want to get rid of God. That's an important area of talking about. So I'm not surprised this came up.
Over the years that you've been doing the show, the ministry, what's the response been? Obviously, a lot of Christians have been encouraged in their faith and have you actually seen non-Christians coming to faith directly through the show?
Yes, but we don't have altar calls. What happens is I'll go out to some other place. I'll go out, speak. I'll visit the UK. You know, I go to these places. People come up to me afterwards and they say, you know, I've been listening for years, and when I started out, I didn't like you at all, or I was angry at you, or I liked you, but I disagreed with you. And then you started making sense, and now I'm a follower of Christ, and now I believe in apologetics, and I'm trying to do my best. The newest member of our speaking staff, J. Warner Wallace, started with Stand to Reason while he was still an atheist on the police department in the Los Angeles area. Yeah. And now he's retired from that. He's written a fabulous book called Cold Case Christianity.
Yeah, I'd love to get him on about it.
Yeah, he'd be sensational to talk with about it. And now he's making his contribution. But there are lots of times that people have come to Christ. They've told me this as a result of our enterprise. But we see the process as a process. It's not an event. It's not like, okay, here I'm seeing this, now become a Christian, but rather we see the process as more like gardening than harvesting, okay? We're just gardening, and every once in a while we get details about the harvest that's resulted, but I'm sure there are many other harvests that we don't hear about. So, yes, this plays into the overall picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I know, that having listened to also to J. Warner Wallace as well on his show, you know,
he fills in for me.
Absolutely.
Now that I'm in the UK,
he's
been taking care of things,
And everything else. And he's talked about the fact that we don't need more million-dollar apologists. We need more a $1 million apologists.
That's right.
Kind of
That's
thing.
Exactly right.
I guess a lot of people may be listening to you tackling these questions, you know, you're very fluid, cogent style, Greg. Think, I could never do that. Yeah. I could never do what Greg's doing.
Well, you don't have to do it.
What is the answer then for those who are sort of thinking, can I?
Well, see, this is where the tactical approach comes in, because with the tactical approach, Justin, you don't have to know all the answers. You can get into play. You can get on the playing field, all right, even though you don't know all the information. You can grow in that gradually. people who use the right questions, and this is core to our tactical approach, the game plan, get into play in very wonderful ways, and then God uses them even if they don't know a lot. But I encourage them to think of themselves as gardeners, just putting a stone in people's shoe, and then you could be very effective.
It's been great having you on the show today.
Justin.
Thank you very much for joining me, Greg Kokel.
My pleasure.
And if you've got anything you want to talk about, respond to from today's show, anything that Greg said or any of our atheist callers today, be delighted to hear from you as well. I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch again in just a moment's time. For the moment, if you do want to check out more about Greg, his ministry, download podcast of Stand to Reason, I really do recommend it. www.str.org. to find out more. That's the website. In the meantime, thanks again, Greg, for being with me on the show today.
That's great. It really was great.
Will you pop in next time you're coming?
Of course, of course.
We'd love to have you back.
I love listening to the British accent. You all sound so intelligent.
That's what people keep saying. Lots of American listeners say, oh, when you read my letter, Justin, I sound 10 times more intelligent. I don't know what that's about, but anyway, I'm glad for that. But in the meantime, thank you very much for sharing your time with us. It's been fabulous. I hope you enjoyed that classic replay with Greg Kokel, and do get in touch with your thoughts on the discussion as well. And if you want anything else from the shows, from the podcast, the videos, resources and more, do check out our website at premierunbelievable.com. For now, thanks for being with us and see you next time.